Thank you, Pat. I don't know if people were rushing in for the conference or for your favorite seat. And not to critique the one who just introduced me, I don't personally find any of the things that you just shared fascinating. The reality is I have been married 35 years. I find that fascinating. And as we begin this conference, as we begin to think about the material that we'll be covering, there are just a few, what I just hope to be a few introductory remarks that you allow me to begin to make, that will guide much of what we do, much of what we think about over the span of this, for many, a very long day, from 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock. Few breaks, the thing that I'm probably most intrigued by, I probably will have to come watch. I hope the material's helpful, but to be honest with you, I'm really looking forward to lunch. because if you look on your schedule, it says that you have 45 minutes to eat. How it is that you will rise, move out of this auditorium, get into line, pass through to receive food, go find a place to sit, and then consume the fine food that you have been given, and then do what most people do, which is to go to some small room, and then to return and find your seat again, and to do all that in 45 minutes. I'm telling you, that comes mighty close to Moses taking 2 million Jews. I mean, honestly, I don't know if you've ever thought about the veracity of that story, but to take 2 million Jews anywhere, seriously, it's just, it demands some level of incredulity. And so that's, I mean, I'm looking forward to being with you. I'm very honored to be invited and very honored to be able to talk about marriage. But I thought it was probably, for disclosure's sake, important for me to say I'm most looking forward to lunch and watching you move. Let me run through the material. If you want to open up your notebooks, on the sheet, let's see, page 3, gives you really the content of much of what we will be covering, and I'd love to just cover it Roman numeral by Roman numeral. A few sentences, and let me tell you how I approach a manual like this. I view it as pristine paper that has unfortunately been marked by someone's outline, which is a way of saying I feel in no way bound to cover anything in this notebook. And if somehow you get to a spot and you go, there was only a sentence, what did he have to say there? Literally, this is yours, do with it what you wish, doodle, take notes, don't take notes. But I don't bind you to what's in here, I certainly don't want to be bound to that either. And so what we'll do is to try to have concepts that we're walking through to give you a sense of, again, where we're going. From my vantage point, marriage is a nightmare. And it is the dream of eternity. I say this with no intent for humor. If you find some level of connectedness to it, it's a natural response to laugh. But I want you to hear very truthfully. I have never known in my life more sweetness and goodness, what it means to be honored, to be loved, and to be delighted in. I have never known more joy on this earth than I have known in my marriage. Nowhere else, no other relationship have I known the kind of taste of heaven that my marriage has brought me. And you're already anticipating, and I will say just what you expect. I as well have never known more horror, more darkness, more shame, more fear. I have never known more of a taste of hell on this earth than I have known through my marriage. So I come to you perhaps with a bit different flavor than some conferences that you may have had before. I don't come to give you much direction. I'm not going to give you helpful suggestions. There are many excellent books that you can read about marriage that will give you some really helpful hints about how to sort of gradate your marriage to become just a bit better, a bit better, a bit better. If you have a good marriage and you are in this room, praise God for you. And there are many in this room who really have come to have sort of a tune-up to their marriage, just help a little bit to grow a bit more. And I'm all for you. But there are others in this room who, when I use the phrase, my marriage has been a taste of hell, are sitting there and probably wanting to elbow the other to go, yeah, for sure, you've been that taste. And your marriage may not be doing well at all. See, one of the dilemmas in doing a conference is I don't know you. I don't know where you are. I don't know what age your marriage is at. I don't know how menopause has affected your sexuality. I don't know how it's affected your sleep. I don't know how it's affected your sanity. I don't know what's happening in your own financial life. There's so many factors to provide you with sort of a, well, what if you do this? What if you try that? If that's the approach that you've been hoping for, that somebody would help you do a bit more to help you move toward a more pleasant, a more thoughtful, a more alive marriage, this is not the conference for you. So let me warn you, you have paid, and there are no refunds. but what I'm hoping to accomplish is to bring you categories, stories and thoughts, reflections from Scripture that if you take into conversation with one another, there's some prospect that what will happen often initially is that your marriage will get tougher, harder, more painful. When you have honest and significant discussions about the reality of who you are in your marriage and who the other is in your marriage, things don't go easily and they don't go well, often quickly. So that's why if what you're looking for is, oh, help us ratchet it up a little bit, I can only say that's not my understanding of how change occurs. I believe change occurs in the context of the desert. And I believe it occurs in the context of the valley of the shadow of death. So your marriage, if you are to become who you are meant to be as a person and as a marriage, it will have to come because you have the courage to enter into the kinds of conflicts which you have largely found ways to either ameliorate or to sidestep. And as a consequence, many times, as we'll talk later in the material, what happens is a level of peace, peace when there is really no peace. You love one another, things are okay, but if you open the door to your in-laws into conversation, you open the door to your sexuality, you open the door to talking about money, you talk about friendships, you talk about the humiliation you felt two nights ago in the context of a group of people where your husband was spotting on about something and you felt just humiliated that he didn't seem to recognize everyone was bored with his story, but yet he continued to yap on. But if you were to say, as the evening ends, I felt humiliated, you don't seem to be able to read the world around you. That would only create a two-week, three-week distance, a kind of frost and cold similar to what's outside. Why bother when what's better, seemingly, is just to be able to get along, be a little bit more pleasant at the breakfast table, be able to be a bit kinder in the middle of conflict? Again, what I want you to hear I'm arguing for from the very beginning is we in our marriage usually settle for so little. And if that is the dunamis of God, if that is really the power of God and the resurrection to simply ratchet our marriages up a little bit, be a little bit kinder, a little bit nicer, a little bit more pleasant, if that's the work of Christ, I would want you to hear I see that as heartbreaking. And as we come to this material, I come for your sake, my sake, but I also come for our culture's sake. And not just to keep and restore marriages, but I do believe, and you'll see as we end our material this afternoon, that marriage will and already has become one of the prime means within our neighborhoods and in our church and in our culture to reveal whether or not there's a God. Does your marriage really tell a story? And does it tell a story of death? Do you know your marriage's death? Do you know what it is for you as a sinner, as one who fails? Do you know the dark consequences that come to your children, to your friends, to your family as a result of the sin that exists between the two of you? Is that language you can bring into the conversation in your neighborhood? Or is it impolite to talk about death? And in our world, it is profoundly impolite to talk about death, to talk about the fact that my wife and I are broken men and women, and that there is sin between us, and that there is actual failure that brings consequences. Is that conversation that actually could come out at a cocktail party? Could that come out in a Bible study? Or do we need to be much more polite with a kind of facade that says, oh, we're Christians, we love one another, we get along, we trust Jesus, things are fine, things are fabulous. Are things fabulous in a marriage that can confess that my marriage has been the context for me to know more about hell than in any other relationship on this earth? We've got to have the courage to be people who know what death is and can speak about it in our lives and in our marriages. But is death the final word? Does it have the final say with regard to our lives? Of course not. The resurrection. So what is it about your marriage that reveals the resurrection to your neighbors? Is there something new, something that has life and goodness and beauty about your marriage that people are able to look into and go, okay, wow, what do you know? Who do you know? How do you live? How do you two have what seems to be a life that I don't taste when I encounter so many other marriages? So what I'm here for is not to ratchet and tune up your marriage. And there are, as I said, excellent, excellent conferences, excellent books that invite that and do that well. But that's not my calling, and it is not why I'm here. I want your marriage to not be better. I want it to be profoundly worse and profoundly better. I want it to know more death and more resurrection, because it is through the story of Jesus, death, resurrection, and ascension, that our marriages are meant to make the story of God known. So if you can leave at 5 today, not with much more clarity, but with a few core concepts, that you begin a process of actually maybe taking the manual out, perhaps you throw it away and lose it, who cares? But maybe it'll be one sentence, maybe it'll a few sentences that will stay with you enough to begin to have conversations with your spouse to say, you know, I never thought my marriage is supposed to reveal death. Yes, your life is meant to reveal death, the death of Jesus. So how does your life and your marriage reveal the death of God? And how does your marriage reveal the life of God, the resurrection? And how does your marriage reveal the ascension of Jesus into heaven and the power that comes when he says, all authority on heaven and earth is now mine, and I dispose it to you? So how is power being lived out in your marriage for good? Those are some of the things that we're going to wander through. So look at page 3. Roman numeral 1, until you face that you have an enemy, till you face that there are things that are opposed to your life and your marriage, then you can more easily, blithely walk through life without, in one sense, opening your eyes to the fact that no marriage, sex does not work easily, conversation does not come naturally. Goodness in your marriage doesn't just come because you committed yourself on the altar to a kind of relationship. We need to know what we're up against. Roman numeral number 2. We need to have an idea of what is the goal of marriage. Is the goal of marriage procreation? Not at all. Do you have to have children in order to have a good marriage? Of course not. And what actually research indicates is your marriage will be much tougher if you have children. But does then that belie what a marriage is meant to be? No, a marriage has a goal. And as we begin to put words to what that goal is, we'll be looking particularly at the material in Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 2. Roman numeral number three, we need to have an idea of the plan. What is God's plan to make a marriage work? And there are three simple categories that we'll find in Genesis chapter 2. You are to leave your mother and father. It will be one thing that we underline a lot over these days. Because what I would say is the majority of people I work with as a marriage therapist have failed to do that very first thing. Leaving your mother and father has nothing, as you'll hear me say later, nothing to do with geography. It has nothing to do with your financial status. Many people have left geographically and financially are quite independent, and they still have not left their mother and father. The leaving of your mother and father has to do with loyalty. To whom are you most loyal? To your socioeconomic past? To your culture? To your race? To your church, to your friends, to your family? Those are all part of the question of, have you left? So in many ways, if you can say what marriage is, that time you stand at the front of an auditorium or a church and you make an oath and vow to one another, the reality of what you're doing at that point so seldom actually gets said. And that is what you're saying to the world is, this is my new loyalty. And that is often obscured because what we wish to do is we want to keep our old loyalties as we indeed make new ones. And that always ends in something foul. Second, we're meant to not just leave, but to somehow become united with one another. And that uniting is an intersection of hearts. And we'll talk about that particularly in the category of how we communicate, how we bring words into our development of intimacy. Loyalty and words are required to get to the third point, and that is to become one flesh. Sex is not an incidental part of marriage. It is not to say that it is the fulfillment of all of what marriage is, and yet, understood well, it is the primary experience for us to understand what it means to know union with God. No wonder that evil has spent ample time from the earliest days of your youth to the days of the last week to in some way spoil, if not ruin, your sense of what is beautiful about sexuality. And so God has a plan. Leave, cleave and weave. And that plan then has Roman numeral four, a problem. And that is, God's plan does not work. I'll try to put more words to that when we get to that, but to say that God's plan doesn't work means this. There's something that intrudes in the plan of God, and that is sin. And if we do not deal with the nature of sin and its force and power, and how it plays out, particularly as we look at Genesis chapter 3, in which we look at the role of male and female, as we look at the consequences that come to a man as a result of his rebellion, and to a woman. And one of the words that you'll hear me use for all of us is this: the effect of sin plays out most deeply in our marriage, more so than any other relationship on earth. And the relationship between husband and wife is the conflict between male and female. And it's the conflict at one level, every woman at core bears an ongoing heartache with loneliness. It isn't to say men do not suffer and struggle with loneliness, but what I would wish to say is that most men struggle far more deeply with a sense of futility and failure. So between loneliness and futility, much of the conflicts that we have really aren't about our in-laws, though they are. They're not really about money. They are. They're not really about sex, though they are. They're not just about our children, but they are. But they're about something far deeper, and that is the consequences of the curse. And for us to understand what we're warring against puts us in the final category, and that is, what does redemption look like? What does it mean to have more than a better marriage? What does it mean to have actually more than just a good marriage? What does it mean to have a marriage that reveals the heart of Jesus? So if that's what you're here for, to at least ponder with me for a day, then my hope would be that as you depart and as you re-enter your world this evening, as you go into next week, yes, I'll make some very few suggestions as to what I would hope you would do with this material with one another. So to that end, let me take a moment and pray with you. Father, Son, Spirit, glory, glory to you, Trinity. Glory to you that you have called each of us to be here. And we ask in these moments for your provision, for concentration, for focus, for the ability perhaps to put aside things that are buzzing in our pockets right now, or concerns that we have to check on at the first break. Jesus, would you keep all the distractions that could so easily keep us from this labor, would you keep them from us long enough that our hearts are open to begin to engage what you would desire? And it is what you desire, that our hearts long to desire more. We want to be connected to you. We want to be bound to you. We want your life to be our life, and we want your life to be the life of our marriage. So Jesus, I know only too well, nothing good can happen without your Spirit's work in each of us. So I would ask your Spirit to attend to whatever one or two sentences that are designed for each person in this room. I know that you would not have allowed us to invest this time unless your presence was here and that you were at work. And so we, your people, submit our hearts to you, ask that you would be at work, and that indeed, oh Lord Jesus, goodness, goodness would come. We ask that in your powerful name. Amen. Well, let me take you now to page one. Oh, no, page four. And what we'll begin to do is to move our way through this and to begin to talk about the nature of the enemies that you face. The first category is the enemy of the world. And most of this is so, I think, obvious that it bears just the mention so that you have categories to reflect on. I think the world as we know it is a world that probably can be best described as distracting. There's noise on in most every home. The average number of TVs in the average American home is four. I think that is something close to the word blasphemous. The average American watches 4.6 hours of TV a day. So if there be any one thing that this conference might do on your behalf, it's to have at least somebody say, 4.6 hours of your precious life being drawn, irrespective of the quality of the programming, the brilliance of the writing, the beauty of the panoramic work of the camera. All I can tell you is 4.6 hours is darkness for a human heart. So if that's what's happening in your marriage, that you basically come home from work, turn the TV on, and the TV mediates on your behalf relationships. You go into your father, mother's home, and the TV's on. Let me invite you to what Kafka would do. And that is, I think he would take a pickaxe and he would rip it through the front of the screen. It would be an honorable way to be kicked out of your family. Distractions are there with regard to what occurred several nights ago in New York at the Philharmonic as they were playing Mahler's Ninth, and in the front rows, a cell phone went off, a marimba. I think the conductor did what all of us dream of doing, and that is focusing upon the person who has committed this cultural violation, and on behalf of all of us, shaming that person so that they will never, ever own a phone again. The dilemma is, I've also been that one, and so it's also the utter horror. In fact, I checked my pockets right before I got up here just to make sure I didn't have my cell phone. Distractibility. Facebook. I'm convinced it's a phenomenal tool for I don't know whom, but I'm not convinced the purposes of life and goodness. When you're spending hours playing games, hours on Facebook, hours on TV, all I want you to hear is that is electronic dissociation. It's a way of escaping not merely your marriage, but in many ways, the nature of life itself. So we're up against a world that would rather you invest in a kind of view of capitalism that requires a constant consumer orientation, which means buying and being the newest and the latest, whether that is the iPad 3, whether that is the iPhone 5, really your new iPhone 4, new is no longer 2 years. Again, the definitions of what is good and true and beautiful have changed in our culture so dramatically that it virtually requires you be wacky and weird to not submit to the distractions of this world. So to simply ask a simple point for a week, because it may be all that you could endure, would you silence noise in your home? Would you only give certain periods of time that you put in your calendar to actually check on Facebook? To actually go to email? Would you learn some level of human discipline that doesn't require being in touch with the world at every point? In other words, our technology, in many ways, is an effort to ascribe to the powers of God. It gives us a sense of omnipotence. It's certainly, Google for me, has given me the closest experience of omniscience. And in terms of my technology, Skype and all sorts of other things, I have been on a computer interacting with a person, at the same time on my iPad interacting on Skype and taking a phone call. And at that point, what you can say is, it's as close as I will ever get to the term omnipresence. So rather than spending much more time on this, would you at least own this key word, distractions keep you from face-to-face conversation with your spouse? So if you can begin to measure how much time on Facebook, how much time on email, how much time in front of the TV, how much time in front of any screen comparable to how much time there is face-to-face between you and your spouse, I think most marriages will discover that the preponderance is on screen-to-face, not face-to-face. And so don't tell me that you do not have time for your spouse when you have time for so many other profound distractions. Second enemy, the flesh. And as I understand that term, we'll cover more of it when we come into talking about the nature of sin, but at least to have two categories before we go much further. Jesus talks in Matthew chapter 7 about the nature of sin, and he uses these two key words. You lust, and therefore you are an adulterer. You are angry, and therefore you are a murderer. So when we talk about the flesh as an enemy in your marriage, it is to say that every one of us lives with an adulterer and murderer. If that seems extreme to you, a kind of hyperbolic intensification, all I can invite you to say is, listen to what Jesus says about the human heart. We struggle with lust. Let me define it for you briefly. Lust is desire gone mad. It is desire which largely is utterly legitimate that has become somehow so consuming. It has become so absorbing. It has become so definitional of who we are that in many ways our world revolves around it. So what is lust? Lust is any desire that has become authoritative. It defines how you will spend your time. It defines what you will do. Another way of putting that, but again, if I use this word too quickly, many of you will be able to say, oh, well, that's not me. Another word for it is the word addiction. And many of you are addicted to TV. Many of you are addicted to work. Many of you are addicted to not work. Many of you are addicted to your children. Many of you are addicted to your lawns. I had a neighbor whose garage was really one of the most phenomenal spaces I have ever been in my life. It was, first of all, immaculately clean. I mean, there was not a drop of oil or dirt on the floor. And on the walls were these brown pegboards. Do you know what I mean by that? Brown pegboards. And along each of the pegboards, he had a marking of the tool. You know when there's a crime scene and there's a dead body and they make the outline. So he had sort of dead tool symbols. And almost every morning, Saturday morning, approximately about at 8 in the morning, he would drive out his 1967 Mustang convertible. And not immediately, but he would let it sit there. I think he just wanted to make sure that the ambient temperature of the metal became coalesced with the outdoors, because then about 45, 50 minutes later, around 9 o'clock, he would begin the process. And I've never been able to use the word wash here, because it doesn't feel honest. What would happen over the next 2 hours is he would bathe that car. I think, honestly, if he could have taken that car to his breast, he would have fed it as a mother would her beloved child. And I felt it my calling to enter his world for the gospel. And often what that meant was to create an experience of the valley of the shadow of death. And with this man, all I needed to do was, when I would walk by his car, I would surreptitiously put my finger on it, just a little. He knew, somehow he knew psychically that I had marred his car. And when I went into his garage, I'd always move a tool. And our conversations over a span of many years wasn't about the phenomena of OCD, even though I think absolutely there was obsessive compulsive capacities, but far more, this is where this man found life. He found it in a clean car. He found it in a phenomenally orderly garage. Is it wrong to have a nice car and to keep it clean, or to have a nice garage and to have it orderly? Of course not. But when it becomes your lust, when it becomes your lover, when it becomes something you have bound your heart to, indeed, Jesus calls that adultery. And this man was an adulterer. And how am I going to open the door to the gospel to this man if I don't crease into the issues of his lust? The problem was, when I would do that, he was not fond of people playing with his gods, and no one is. So you have a second category, anger. And what does Jesus say about the nature of anger? Anger is murder. And so this man would press me and he'd go, "You touched one of my tools, didn't you?" I'm not a man who lies, but I also know how not to answer. I said, "Well, it really depends, truly, of course, on what you mean by touch. I certainly have not touched your tools the way you do. What did you move?" "Move." It's a really fascinating notion of matter in space, volume with speed. "Don't give me that. Did you touch one of my tools?" "Yes, I did." "Which tool?" "Close your eyes, my friend, and see if you can psychically feel which one it was." I'm a neighbor that's very easily capable of provoking anger. Why? Well, because my commitment is an invitation for you with me and me with you to mess with gods that you are not meant to love. Your life is so much more beautiful, so much more stunning and glorious to be captured by that which is lesser, when there is so much to be captured for that which is glorious. So I'm not afraid of anger. I'm not afraid of your anger. I'm not afraid of my anger. So I'll step into anger to begin the stirring of the pot. And there comes what? The desire to say, "Don't you mess with my gods. You mess with my gods and I will kill you." And do you understand that you are sitting next to, assuming you're with your spouse or with a friend, so, you know, you're with somebody who matters probably. You are sitting next to a sinner. Duh. I got you on this one. You can't work against me on this. Why? Because the scriptures work with what I'm trying to say. You say you're not a sinner, you're a liar. 1 John 1:9. But if you admit you're a sinner, then what I've asked you to be able to admit is everyone in this room struggles with lust and anger. Whether you have actually committed something called an affair, adulterous affair, whether you've had encounter and experience with pornography, whether you've been involved in an emotional liaison that had a kind of life and intimacy that sometimes even your marriage doesn't seem to bear,
I don't care what the categories are. I'm saying you're the one of the purest men and women in this room. Everyone in this room struggles with lust. Otherwise, you're not a sinner. Everyone in this room struggles with anger. And what I'm asking you to be aware of is that is influencing every single moment in your marriage. There are no neutral moments. There are no moments where, oh, we've had a day where there's no sin. Wow, yeah. Really? How did you pull that one off? I beg of you, I will actually pay you to be able to follow a sinless person for at least 1 hour. And I promise you, because I have fairly good eyes, you will not, after the hour, be able to say, I was sinless. No one can. So will we own that one of the enemies isn't so much our sin, but it is. It's something actually even darker than merely our sin. It's our self-righteousness. There's nothing more deadly to a marriage than the denial of sin. To the degree you do not know the word adulterer about your own heart, to the degree you do not know the word murderer with regard to your own heart, because you're a very sweet and kind and godly and truly sincere man or woman. Bless you for all those words, but I'm asking of you something more, and it's this. Will you face the fact that in every marriage there are two adulterers and two murderers who oftentimes are living with the veneer of something even more dark and dangerous, and that is self-righteousness? Me, a murderer? I'm not a murderer. I'm not angry. You're angry. I'm not angry. You have gods that are not God. Oh, no, no. I love Jesus. I'm a follower of Christ. I have no God but God. I don't know how to help you because I'm a profoundly faithless husband. I'm a really dangerous man. I have betrayed my wife. And if you need for me to say this, I will be glad to say, I have never had an affair with another human being. I've had tens of thousands. Not one, tens of thousands. And there have been moments in my anger where my wife has literally cowered in my presence and felt fear that she would be hurt. I've been angry enough to smash glass in her presence. And in some sense, that's spousal abuse. Have I ever hit my wife? Do I need to do this for you? Have I ever hit my wife? No. Have I ever thrown an object at my wife? No. But what's the difference in the middle of rage, taking a glass and shattering it on the floor? Have I not symbolically said, I could shatter you? And what happened to her adrenaline, nor epinephrine? What happened to her cortisol? Nothing different than if she were in the middle of being physically harmed. So when I say I've known hell, I've created hell. And I can say I've been part of creating something phenomenally beautiful and heavenly. But if you don't own the enemy, if you don't own the enemy of distractibility and the enemy of your own heart, then you'll hardly ever get to the third issue. And that is you actually have another enemy. And for lack of time and certainly opportunity at this juncture, let me simply say, I believe in an external enemy that is a actual, I don't want to even use the word being, but it's a word that's a common word, a kind of being in the world that is in opposition to God. It's not a concept. It's not merely a power. It's an entity with intentionality, with design, and with desire. And it wishes to destroy you, you personally, and your marriage. And generally speaking, it's called Satan, Beelzebub, the devil. Evil itself, the evil one. However you would frame it, let me simply say, I believe evil is doing these three things. It is constantly working to thieve from you, steal. But I would argue it's little interested in the category of breaking and entering. It isn't particularly interested of just breaking into your home and taking a valued possession, Far more, evil loves to do sting operations where it gets you to participate in your own destruction, which is why one of the prime tools of evil with regard to thievery is temptation. The temptation to have a kind of playful, fun conversation with somebody at work that feels sweet and alive, that you actually look forward to as you're driving to work. Are you having an affair? Of course not. But it's just fun. And you left a argumentative state, or maybe even worse, just insipid nothingness. Are you going to pick the dog up this afternoon? Uh-huh. You pick the kids up. What's for dinner? I don't know. Let's order out. How about Thai? I'm tired of Thai. Okay, Indian? No, I can't stand it. I get heartburn. What do you want? I don't know. You figure it out. Okay, see you tonight. And then you go into the office, and there's a playful interaction with the individual just across the cubicle. How long does it take before the contrast between sort of the dull, insipid, burdensome relationship with your spouse is in contrast to the sweetness that's there in the relationship with somebody who you would no more have an affair with than you'd shoot yourself? And yet, there's a life there between the two of you that is not there in your marriage. And all evil needs to do over any length of time, and trust me, evil works decadally. Generally, temptation is not something that comes today and is operated on tomorrow. Temptation, for the most part, takes a long incubation that will slowly work you to divide with your spouse. Second word is that evil not just thieves, but evil kills. And do you think that just means evil takes a 9mm, puts it to your head, pulls the trigger, you're dead? In many ways, that would be almost a sweet gift. To have evil take my life, like right now, like, okay, I'm okay. I mean, this would be a rather intriguing, dramatic exit. I want to thank you all for coming. It's been great, but I'm out of here. Where would I be? On the floor, but whoever I am, most am, would be in the very face of God. So do you think evil is committed to physically killing you? Oh, no, 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 no. Evil loves torture. Torture that leads to a broad term, dissociation. Another word for that is numbness. A kind of today is the same as yesterday, and it will be the same as tomorrow. There are no real differences. Everything is the same. Nothing new. Just do it, do it, do it again, do it, do it, do it again. So what's the nature of deadness? There's no deep desire that feels alive and free and lovely. You have learned to anesthetize yourself. So is evil at work? Yes, tempting you. Is evil at work? Yes, shutting down desire, annulling, learning over seasons that to want in your marriage will lead to more pain, not pleasure. Which is why many marriage books and many marriage conferences will work with you and affirm the category of having reasonable expectations. Your expectations are just too high. And with them being so high, you're really disappointed. And in that disappointment, you get angry. And in that anger, you're pushing your spouse away. So what's the problem? Lessen your desire, learn to mitigate your expectations, and somehow your marriage will become more tolerable. Sounds so reasonable. But problematically, it's not biblical. Our heart for heaven is meant to grow. And as our heart for heaven grows, the ache for return becomes even deeper. And the ache itself is meant to stir within us a kind of hope and energy that invites us to a life of even greater righteousness and goodness. So if you annul desire, I believe you are working unwittingly
in accord with your enemy who wants for you to be dead. Final word. What does evil do? It steals, it kills. Next word, it destroys. And I don't think there's any truer sentence. What evil wishes to do is to mar your face. Does your face shine when you get to talk about your husband? Many of you love one another. Bless you for that love. It is lovely. The question that probably is more true for many of us is, I know my wife loves me, but there are many days I'm not sure she likes me. I know she loves me, and at one level, as a Christian, it's wicked for me to use language like this, but let me. She loves me because she has to. She's supposed to. God tells her to. But do you like me? I know the days when I return home, I open the door, and I hear from either the kitchen, the living room, from upstairs, Shuggy! I can spend a whole day in all sorts of bizarre activities, many of which I would much prefer never to have suffered. For one 2-second burst of consonants and vowels linked together with that word, Shuggy. And what it says to me is, my wife is happy to have me home. And does it come every day? No. And when I don't hear it, I can tell you my brain starts working. Like, what do I know that her day held? What did I do wrong this morning? What might have gone on between us during the day? And I'm wondering what's keeping us from that linguistic glory of how she speaks a word of endearment to me. Evil wants to mar your face, and it wishes to do so through your sexuality, through failures that need forgiveness, that you cannot forgive yourself for, you cannot forgive the other for. Evil wants for there to be marks on our face that cause us to turn away from face-to-face encounter. Those are your enemies. And what is the plan of God? Next page. Roman numeral number 2. Assuming. And do you hear what we've just done? Pedagogically, I've just gone from Roman numeral number 1 to number 2. How helpful is that? Not much. In the design of what would be best, what I would say to you is, bless you over the next 2 weeks. I will be back. Hopefully you'll be back. We'll deal with Roman numeral number 2. Please go have a conversation about the enemies in your marriage. You don't have a conversation about that? The passing through that material is already lost to you. If you can't answer this, how are you distracted? Not if you are. How are you distracted? And will you begin to account for your distractibility? And until you get numbers before you, that will be a useless construct. What does it mean for you to own that you are an adulterer? The only way to begin to approach that is, what are the gods that you love more than the God of the universe? That is a very hard ownership. How do you make people pay? How do you make your spouse pay? You don't make your spouse pay, then you are one blind man or woman. How do you withdraw relationship? How do you involve yourself in flight? How do you stonewall? How do you freeze? How do you bring language against the other that diminishes, that demeans, that brings contempt against the other? Till you answer those questions, the material we just covered just can't go from Roman numeral number 1 to 2. And until you begin to pray, Jesus, help me reveal where the evil one is working to tempt me, tempt my marriage.
How is it working to annul, to deaden? And what are the marks I already feel on my face or my marriage that feel like they are spots that can never be removed? As much as you cry out, out, damn spot, the blood seeps before you and the accusations are never abated. Please do the work. But the cost of doing that work is entering heartache and conflict. But assuming you're willing to do the work, then it is important that you know, what is this all about? What is it for? Roman numeral number 2. And what you'll hear me talk about is growing the glory of our calling, growing the glory of our gender, and growing the glory of intimacy. So underneath those core words is the word growing glory in our calling, in our gender, and in intimacy. If you have your Bibles, a passage that we'll stay with for quite some season is Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3. Starting with verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make human beings in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, over the livestock, and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created human beings in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." That is the purpose of marriage. And it would be delightful if all I needed to do was to read that and to go, that's why you're married. This gives you your North Star as to what your life is meant to be about. And we'll spend a bit of time trying to take those concepts simply a little further. First of all, is the word glory. You need to have at least a beginning understanding of what the word glory means, to grow glory in the other. Glory, probably best translated by a Hebrew word, kavod, transliterated K-A-V-O-D, kavod, is one of those words that, like in Hebrew, there are many, where you look at the word and go, it means this, but it also means this. And so it means both, but actually more. A way of putting it very quickly, it's a word that defies definition. It's a word that will not allow you to gain control even over its linguistic presence. Do you know what the word means? No. Do you know what the word means? Yes. What does the word mean? It has two primary meanings. The first is the image of something that shimmers with light. If you're on a lake, spring, summer, and you look over how the sun creases the water, and it's like there are 10 million shining diamonds glittering on that surface. That's glory. When something captures your eye and you go, wow. Now, I'm not trying to argue what is beautiful, but to say as you stand before the Grand Canyon and you look into this just phenomenal hole in the ground, and you stand there and go, wow. That's what glory brings you, is a sense that you are standing in the presence of something more beautiful than you, something that takes your breath away. I hope you've had moments where you know what beauty is, where you have been in the presence of a Sunset or a Monet or even a Klee, and you've seen something that just virtually makes you feel like the ground is moving below me. Whether that is in the last or in the first 11 seconds of an overtime where a ball is thrown and it takes your breath away. If that moves you, I'm all for you, but that's more just bizarre. But I have to confess that I was at a state fair once, and I walked by a man who had what I would view as the absolute quintessential beer belly I've ever seen on this earth. And he had a very tight white t-shirt, the proverbial wife beater, and I could not keep my eyes off of him. And I said to my wife, I'm sorry, text me, I've got to follow this man. So if you think of beauty as sort of the painter who paints scenes that are pristine, that have sort of this utter ambience of intense light coming from the canvas, I'm well with you that that's beautiful. But I also think Picasso's Guernica is one of the most beautiful paintings that you can see. So it isn't just that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. There's an element of subjectivity to all beauty, of course. But what I'm saying is beauty has something that forces you to see the world in a new light. It forces you to, in many ways, re-encounter what you heard, saw, felt before, but now there's something about it that virtually causes you to go, what? What? Wow. And there are so many moments in my relationship with my wife where my wife has spoken but a few sentences or a few words or a look that had so much life and courage and goodness and truth to it that all I could do as she spoke the words, even though I hated what she said, to be in awe of her. That's what beauty does. It brings you that sense of, wow. Second word, what does glory mean? It actually has the meaning, kavod, of the word thick. Not exactly a word that you would want to apply as to what you would wish for your spouse. But as you understand what the word thick means here, it means substantial. It means like a metal. It's got strength to it. It's got a force to it. It's got a weight to it. You just can't put your hand through glory. There is a volume to it. So in that sense, it is something that you are not only in awe over, there's something in it that requires you to submit to it, to call it good. And what I want you to hear is we're moving toward a very simple category. Glory causes you to worship. And if there's one sentence so far that I'm hoping will remain after so much verbiage has been floating out before you, it's that your marriage is meant to cause you to worship. When you look at your spouse, there ought to be, not every moment, because that would be beyond a sinner's capacity, but there is meant to be a sense in which you look at one another and you go, wow, wow, you love me? You want to be with me? You like me? Wow. And it is a force, a presence. It's not ephemeral. It cannot be blown away like smoke. It's got a force and substance to it that allows me to have a ground I could have by no other means. In that sense, what it leads to is this sense of thank you. Thank you. And that's what a marriage is meant to bring, awe and gratitude. So if you have come in your marriage to a point where, oh, I know him, I know her, know what she's going to say, know what she's going to do, you have allowed familiarity to breed not merely contempt, but distraction. You have bound them into a particular way of being, and ultimately you don't believe the resurrection can be true for your spouse or your marriage. Evil's won. Yeah, you're faithful. You're going to stay loyal. You're going to stay committed. You're not going to divorce. Great. Wonderful. And yet, you're a dead marriage. Why? Because you have lost awe in one another. and you've lost the ability to look at the other and to be able to say, thank you, thank you. And for them to be able to return to you and say, no, thank you. And for you to be able to restore and be able to say, no, thank you for thanking me. And for the other to be able to say, without it seeming silly, no, thank you for thanking me for having thanked you. And for the other then to be able to say, in a way that just isn't a matter of, it's dinner time, let's pray. Or it's the beginning of the day, let's pray. It's the end of the day, let's pray. But where there's a sense in which, I don't know how to be with you, given who you are and the awe I feel, and indeed the delight of gratitude that I know. I know of no way to thank you enough. My wife and I were on a flight many years ago from Denver to Chicago. And as we lifted off from Denver, I heard an explosion. I fly a great deal. And my wife looked at me at this point. It was a loud explosion. And she looked and she said, is everything okay? And I looked at her and I said, no, it's not. That was louder and more severe than anything I've ever heard. Oh, a minute later, the pilot got on with the typical pilot's voice. Folks, right there it says everything, doesn't it? Folks, you might have heard a small noise. Small noise! It was an explosion. And it wasn't small. I know, he's trying to keep us calm rather than all rushing to the exits and leaping out. Folks, you might have heard a small explosion or a small sound. We're checking that out, but there are no worries. Oh, sure. You're checking it out, but you're telling me there are no worries. Just tell me the truth. You don't know what's happening either. And you're panicking as well. But it's probably wise for us all to remain calm until we begin to shout that these are the final moments on Earth. He comes back on and says, folks, we've discovered, we've had a small explosion. That was interesting. He actually used the word. He said, we apparently have lost our tires. So we're making a decision now whether or not we're going to be flying around Denver until we burn up some fuel or whether we're going to head on to Chicago. We'll let you know in a few moments. Okay. I was a lot more honest than I would wish. So he comes back on and says, you know, folks, we've decided we'll proceed on to Chicago, burn up fuel on the way, and the equipment in Chicago actually is better. We'll be making a kind of a touch-and-go landing. Well, the next 3 hours and about 12 minutes, it was the longest 3 hours on a flight I've ever had, quiet as could be. I thought it was stunning that they gave free alcohol to everyone in economy. And about 45, 50 minutes before we landed in Chicago, they talked with us about how to do the brace position and explained that we would have a foamed runway and that when the plane stopped, we needed without our luggage and our bags to make our way to that opportunity to jump out of a plane into a slide. That should be a lot of fun. At the point of realizing this is not small. Well, it so happened that the night before, the dream that I had was of a flight hitting the ground and turning back in the air, flipping over, and bursting into flames. I don't dream like that very often. So I'm thinking, dream experience. Literally, I don't want to exaggerate. It was a time of danger and with uncertainty. I don't know what you would do in those moments. Do you have a sense of what you would most want to say to your spouse if these are some of the final moments on earth? Do you have visions of how you will one day be, assuming that you will live 20, 30, 40, 50 more years? Do you know how you want to end? It will mostly determine how you live today. And on that plane, as you can likely tell, I am a moderately loquacious man. And I found myself sitting next to my wife. And every now and then I'd want to look at her and say, this is what you mean to me. This is what our, at that point, 22 years of marriage, this is what I have known because of you. But almost every time I would turn to her to begin that process to say, these are words I wish to speak before, if indeed these are the final moments on this earth, these are the things I wish to say. But every time I began to speak, it wasn't that I was afraid of tears. It's just that I could not find words. Everything that I wanted to say felt like, you know, I love the way you wear your hair. You know, you were a great mom. Do you remember when we went to Austria? Do you remember how the fog rolled in and how we laid in that bed for 2 days? What do you say? All I could muster was to look at my wife and just say, thank you. Thank you. And all she had the ability to do at that point was to look back and say, you're welcome. And remember at some point kind of going, and she looked at me and she just goes, I'll say it when I'm ready. And I'm going, what? We're about to die and this is the time you say what you want to say. And she goes, not on your time. Not when you want. When I'm ready, you'll hear what's in my heart. You see, those are the kind of moments where you go, it's the holding of awe and gratitude. It's the ability to go, who are you? Who are you? I know your name. I know where you were born. I know your mother and father. I know your brother and sister. I know so many of your stories. But I want you to hear, awe comes from the awareness that your spouse is an unexplored continent. And maybe after 35 years of marriage, I maybe have made it from the East Coast, maybe into the Midwest. But I would need several lifetimes to even be able to grasp a bit more of the nature of who she is. Do you then see what the nature of glory is? Glory is awe and gratitude that has that ongoing evolution of a sense of, I get the privilege, I and only I have the privilege of being married to this one woman and she to one man, and we've got a lifetime, I pray for many more decades, to be able to explore this radically odd, bizarre, beautiful, troubled, broken, and absolutely compelling woman. And I would hope if she were here in her own time, she would say the same. What's glory? Glory is the very character of God. What do we know about glory? It is that God is glorious. And he takes our breath away, and he leads us to gratitude. And so in that sense, our marriage is meant to take us into the ultimate sense that there is a God, and he is good, and we are right to submit our lives to him and right to receive from him all that he would desire for us to have and to be able to say to him, thank you, thank you. Now, we're to do that in three categories: calling, gender, and intimacy. Let me start with the first. We'll at least make an initial movement into it. What is the nature of our calling? Again, the passage already told us, but let's take a moment to underscore two key categories. First is this: to live out our calling on this earth, you first of all must fill and multiply. That's what it says. Fill and multiply. The second calling is to subdue and rule. And the NLT
translates that, I think, better than the word rule, because the notion of ruling for many has a category that is oppressive and rightfully at times true. The word the NLT uses is the word reign. You are meant to be the presence of the one who tends and causes the world around you to become more beautiful. To reign is to serve. To subdue is to serve. So what are we called to? Two words: fill, multiply, subdue, and rule. And let's spend a few moments on each, and then we'll take a break. To subdue and rule, to fill and multiply, please hear, all men, all women are meant to do both. It isn't women do one, men do one. The passage does not make that kind of differentiation. So if we stick with what the text is implying, then all men, all women, fill and multiply, subdue and rule. And what you will find, if I can just give you a hermeneutical principle, especially as we get to Genesis chapter 3 and talk about the consequences of the failure of Adam and Eve, you're going to hear language that is very concrete. When we talk about the consequence for a woman, it will be that she bears suffering in childbirth. And for a man, that he will sweat and bleed as he tends to the garden. Are those concrete categories? Absolutely. Are they categories of menses, menstruation, birth pangs and labor? Absolutely. But are they more than that? Oh my gosh, absolutely. In other words, if you're not a farmer, do you escape the consequences? If you don't have children, you escape the consequences? No, of course not. So in the same light, I want you to hear, fill and multiply has a primary focus of actually bringing children to this earth. Subdue and rule has more language about how you clear a field and how you make it susceptible, available to seed, to be planted, to grow fruit. So are we called to making babies and having productive fields? Of course, yes. But do you hear that doesn't encompass the totality of indeed what we're called to do? I love coming into someone's home. It just makes me happy. I love to come to your apartment, your house, and I hope I will be a good guest. But I can say I'm already warning you. I love to wander. I love to see the things that you have created in your home that mark your home to be your home. Because I spend my life a lot on behalf of the school that I teach at, the Seattle School of Theology and Psychology. I'll tell you more about that later. I do a lot of fundraising, which means I happen to have the privilege of walking into beautiful homes. And I've walked into multi-million dollar homes that within the first, 20 feet, I look at and go, got it. You had a designer, probably cost you $100,000 or $200,000 for this designer to buy some of the finest furniture available around the world. And you have placed that in your unbelievably well-appointed mansion. And what you have created is a hovel. Why? Because there's nothing of you there. Finest magazines, finest designer, you got the money, you bought it. What does it mean to you? I have been in teeny apartments. I have been in cardboard shacks in a Manila barrio. And I have seen stunning beauty. Why? It's how you fill things. It's how you multiply goodness. So you invite me in, I will wander until you tell me, no, that door's closed. And then my response is, I hope, utterly polite, like, okay, but is it well with you if I ask? What would keep that door bolted? Oh, it's a mess. Oh. Look. I mean, do I look to you like someone unfamiliar with darkness, depravity, decadence? I know it well, personally and professionally. So, no, you can't go. Well, I'm well. But as we go through, I want to open drawers. I want to look in closets. When I see the master bedroom, I want to go through your clothes. I know in there are certain clothes and drawers, of course not. But bottom line, I want to see who you are. And that is what you wear. That's what you put on walls. That's the books you have on your shelves. And then I want to look at your books. And then I want to take your books out that I like, because I also want to see how you mark your books. You don't mark your books? You don't mark your books? Seriously, where do you bleed your ideas? I want to see what you underline. I want to see how the world falls in your world. Isn't that where you fill and multiply? So filling and multiply is how you create beauty. So you started an insurance agency. You filled the world with something good. You're working on a dissertation on the concept of the self in a postmodern moment, asking from a psychological standpoint rather than a mere socio or philosophical standpoint, what is the nature of what it means to be me? You're filling the world with goodness. How you tend and grow the plants, the flowers in your yard, it's filling. And none of that's small. Nothing is small that you do on this earth. Nothing. So filling and multiplying has then to do with a second word, and that is tending, subduing, ruling. Where do you put your mark on this earth so that one can say, without you being here, something about God would not have been revealed? So to subdue and rule means simply to mark the world so that it reveals the very God who has written you to be who you are. What do you wear? How do you dress? What car do you drive? I have a dear friend who teaches Old Testament. Actually, it's not my best friend, but another friend in Santa Barbara. And his car is filled with thousands of coffee cups. After every coffee he drinks, he throws it in the back. And I always want to see Randy's car because his car reveals something about the nature of who he is and how he lives. Is that bizarre? Sure, but that's the nature of who you are. If you were like anyone else in the room, you wouldn't have the privilege to reveal what is unique about God. So what is true about you that then becomes true about the other, that becomes true about this entity called a marriage? Two words. To create the opportunity for beauty to grow and then for it to mature is the very nature of what our calling is. When we come back from a break, 30 minutes, we'll begin to deal with what it means to do with calling, gender, and intimacy. Have a good break. We'll be right back.